You know, it's a little scary to think Hawaii's state government servers are under attack 45 million times a day. But that's what we're up against in this day and age of cyber attacks. October happens to be Cyber Awareness Month, and that's why we invited Vincent Huang into our studios. He is the Chief Information Officer for the state of Hawaii.
Well, a lot of the threats we have are automated. And so that's why when you hear numbers like 45 million a day, that it sounds very, very alarming at first. But when you think about it, the adversary, the bad actors, what they do is they go for low-hanging fruit. And how to do that at scale is to just have these automated attacks go. So from the state of Hawaii infrastructure, we push back or we deflect these type of probes and alerts. And the number is roughly 45 million a day still. It hasn't really changed all that much in 2 years. And my interpretation of that is that we've, from the state of Hawaii, we've really, really strongly pushed forward of moving our infrastructure into public clouds. And so the numbers we measure are mostly based on the on-premises infrastructure that we're currently protecting.
And then how do we educate our government workers about the best practices so we don't expose ourselves to problems?
A lot of it is education, communication, building awareness. So we send off notifications on a regular basis. If there are any new incoming threats, we'll send it off to the various departments and agencies and provide, have those coordinators filter that information and send it off to the actual staff. In addition, ETS, that's the office that I work for, the Office of Enterprise Technology Services. We have a we have funding to provide cybersecurity awareness training to all the supported agencies. And so it's a process of working with the various agencies to adopt and onboard the cybersecurity awareness training to help push that education to the staff.
Yeah, because we've got to be on our toes because there's so many different things that move at such a high rate of speed, right? It's something morphs into something else. We've heard of lots of states, the ransomware, you know, that's been a real problem.
Ransomware is a very scary thought. But as far as mitigations go, if you just simplify and break that down to the problem set, it becomes simple in concept. The best way to respond to a ransomware threat is to simply have good backups. Because if your data is wiped, you have something solid to restore from. That truly is the strongest effort that you need to put in to make sure you have a good backup, that it's offline, so that if something happens to your machine, you have the ability to restore data offsite.
And I've seen stories where a lot of institutions or lots of entities will just, you know, pay up so they can, you know, whether they're hospitals or financial institutions, you know, private businesses.
Yes. As far as the ransom threat goes, it really, really does highlight that we as an institution aren't good at getting the fundamentals down. If you do a review of the ransomware attacks that have hit municipalities, private businesses, and what have you, is that we're not being consistent at the fundamentals. We're not getting the basics done correctly. Example is keeping up with technology, just updating your infrastructure, updating your systems. A common example that I throw out is with Microsoft Windows. The state, we're over 70% as far as the endpoints go running on Windows 7. That reaches end of life on January 14th, 2020. And so there's been a very, very large push, initiative, to get all these endpoints migrated off of Windows 7 onto a modern operating system. On the Windows side, it's Windows 10 today. But it's so very simple in concept, upgrade your software, but the actual implementation, being consistent in doing it, that's really the hard challenge.
And I remember a couple of years ago at a conference, a statewide conference, I think the technology guy was pointing out that we had some old Wang computers in operation, and he was crediting the employees for keeping them going. But at some point, you know, you've got to say we have to modernize. And
we do, yes.
Because those are vulnerabilities, I would imagine.
Modernization is a very, very strong effort. From my perspective, I see the state has roughly four generations of technology infrastructure. You know, we can go as far back as the mainframe. So we update that hardware regularly. It's current, but the software that sits on top of it, it's 30, 40 years old. Next generation would be the physical servers, infrastructure, that's still sitting around in a lot of agencies out there. The third generation that I refer to is the virtualization side. So many departments and agencies have modernized to the part where they are no longer dependent on physical equipment and have virtualized on-premises infrastructure. That's what we do at ETS here. We have what we refer to as the government private cloud. And for all the agencies that don't have sensitive regulated data, we are able to provide this common shared environment so that we can help speed up service and simplify the maintenance of it. For other areas where things are more highly regulated, what we're working now is pushing this refresh into public clouds. For the technically inclined, there's a standard referred to as FedRAMP, and what that means is there's a federal requirement that has a very robust level of security and compliance that's been defined, and we leverage the public clouds that have put in that effort to figure out the compliance and security requirements to properly safeguard the information that we put there.
And so talk about the insurance, because like how do we make sure that if there are any losses that we're covered?
Well, so we can try to pull on that thread a little bit. With liability insurance, a lot of it helps pay for the response exercises, the response process. So if we get hit by something really catastrophic, it could be ransomware, it could be a physical failure, it could be, and most commonly it's just simple human failure, human error. Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, human error. Part of their relief efforts would go into identifying if the information isn't available at all. And then in addition to the actual technical side of bringing in external resources, if we need a staff augmentation, what have you, and there's also the communication side of having external parties, maybe additional attorneys, communications, media specialists, and even up setting up a call center of some sorts to handle those things. So the liability insurance itself doesn't pay just for the loss of the data, but it's the overall response effort to help mitigate the issue.
And so how do we compare? How does Hawaii compare to other states across the country?
I would like to think that we're just the same as other states throughout the country.
We're all in the same boat.
I feel it that way. It's because I've met with other CISOs in other states, and we all face the same problems. They're slightly different, but overall, if you just distill it down, we're all trying to deal with the same problems. It's just taking a different tact at it. But one of the things that gets folks a little excited is that early this summer, there were some news articles out there that was referring to Hawaii as being the number one at-risk state from the cybersecurity perspective. And how they got there was that they took the FBI data of financial-related losses that have been reported to the IC3, and then they did some math, converted those losses to per capita, and then put in the, also weighted it against how much the state disclose with respect to election security, and also if there was a line item in the budget that referred to cybersecurity. The way that data analysis was done, we pretty much got zero on the election security communications and zero on the budget. But the reality for us is that we do have a budget. It was $2 million ongoing, and then we just got an approval for an additional $1 million to help improve our cybersecurity efforts. And on the election security side, there was a recent statute for us to go to an all-mail in ballots situation. So that shifts the dynamics of where the cybersecurity risk is.
So just unfortunate that those parameters of that survey gave us the bad score.
Yes, it's how to spin things with statistics, right? Because Hawaii, in that report, it got ranked as number one. But if you took a look at the actual FBI data, we actually rank from the number of victims and number of dollar of losses, we actually rank at 42. So, that's a positive picture. Now, the bad picture, however, is that in 2018, I believe the number, as far as the financial loss, was about $6.4 million. And for the 2019 statistics, we're only three quarters of the way into the year now, but the current losses are measured at $6.8 million.
Whoa.
So good that we're not really at number one, but bad that the crime rates, losses that are being reported are climbing and climbing.
You've been listening to the state's information officer, Vince Wong. We've been talking about cybersecurity. Did you know the three most common breaches are with phishing, passwords, and patches? So think before you click, change your passwords and strengthen them often, and update your software. We'll be right back. This morning, our studios played host to the CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Patricia Harrison is in Honolulu to present a free public talk at the East-West Center tonight. The focus will be the resilient Fourth Estate, how factual-based journalism can survive in the digital era. She sat down with us this morning to talk about the digital divide.
When I first came to CPB, I needed my own framework for how are we doing things. We're doing a lot of great things, investing money. We're the steward of the federal appropriation. We have to prove every year how we took care of this money, and it really accrued to the benefit of the American people. And working with our board and general managers, we came up with sort of a shorthand, the three Ds we called digital diversity and dialogue. And the whole idea was looking at how we were going to connect to an audience now on the go who had the means of producing and talking back, and how can we be relevant in their lives. And the three Ds really mean we always have to be innovating. You never get to a place where you say, well, that's it. This is the last technology we'll invest in. Diversity, sort of writ large in terms of diversity of race and heritage and gender, geography, point of view. We always want to have a representation of what an increasingly diverse America now looks like. And then dialogue is really engagement, but it didn't start with an E, so I had to it's get into the community, reflect the community. The community will tell you what their information needs are, what their content needs, education needs. And if we could just focus on this little mantra. It doesn't have to be the three Ds in every single thing, but certainly two out of three most of the time. And as a result, our funding focused on content that we'd make a concerted effort to bring in new talent, diverse voices. In terms of diversity or dialogue, all of that has to go hand in hand. So the technology can't be the only thing you're focused on if the content isn't there. But you have to have the technology, up-to-date technology. And we've invested millions of dollars in helping stations move into this digital era. Things such as the digital accelerator, digital immersion training, investing in digital first content. And as we look at, we're supposed to, as part of our mission, pay attention to unserved and underserved audiences. So these kids are being inundated 24/7. And half the time, you don't know what links they're on leading to inappropriate material and content. And so the PBS NewsHour and PBS Digital Studios, we're trying to stay with those kids, those early learners, into that next preteen area, which is getting more mature, unfortunately, all the time, and provide them with that safe place where they can learn on the internet.
You know, I know they were always talking about how public broadcasting does great for the young minds, you know, with Sesame Street and all those wonderful shows on TV. And then, like you mentioned, the NewsHour, but then it was the gap in between is trying to get those
That's what I'm
people.
Looking at now, because I have a 10-year-old grandson, and it's amazing how quickly, if they're online, what can happen, even with parental controls. And so our content is pristine and rated by all kinds of different measures and educators as helping children to learn. But we do lose those kids after the age of like 6, 7, or 8. And so that means we have to have content that appeals to them in ways that appeal to digital natives. And that's what they are. They are so super techno savvy. And we're looking at, you know, public media. We take our time doing the research. We're working with PRI, looking at podcasts for kids. And how do we capture that next generation who really, they're going to have to be able to understand what's real, what's not real, what's good and what isn't good in terms of content for their lives.
I know with my children, you know, my daughter's in her 20s, my son's 30, and I credit them because they said, Mom, you should try radio. You should try podcasting, you know, because that's what they were into. You know, my daughter was living in New York and she just was living to podcasts from morning to night.
NPR's numbers are up because of podcasting. But what is podcasting? It's storytelling that connects to someone at a particular moment in their life. And I remember when we began to fund Work It to encourage and inspire women of color to get into podcasting and going to New York and speaking to that first Work It audience. If you want to feel old, there they all were, black leather pants and the Chelsea boots and so much talent. And that's where two dope queens came together and had their first podcast. And out of that, so many incredible stories and connecting that was so raw. So it appeals to what people are doing now. We have a legacy from the last 50 plus years, but how do we stay relevant in people's lives now when they're facing different things, opioids and immigration issues, and they want an outlet where they can connect and say, I'm a person. This is my story. And if public media belongs to everyone, then we have to represent in a way that allows that inclusion in everyone's story.
And I know when I attended my first podcasting conference, it was PodCon, and there were folks that were, you know, dressed as their favorite characters. You know, I was taking pictures and sending to my daughter saying, oh, my gosh, there's pointed ears on this whole row. Yeah.
But it's exciting.
It is. It is. And my son introduced me to Roman Mars.
Yes.
You know, and so it was kind of nice that they're teaching me.
Well, I think that's really important. And it's a place in public media where generations can come together without losing their particular identity. It's something like StoryCorps. Right now, David Isay, who founded StoryCorps on NPR, he's doing One Small Step, bringing together people who have nothing in common and to talk mostly politically, differing views, but in a civil society place, safe place, to just treat one another with respect and talk about their ideas. And it's not the easiest thing to do.
Yes, you know, I think we all need a break from some of the yelling that we hear on the airwaves.
Well, I think that's why public media is so trusted. We don't do much yelling at all, if any. And we take the time and we tell the story and with the facts. I'm amazed right now that we're inundated with what they call fake news. In my opinion, if it's news, it's not fake. So how you define something as fake news, the cat either died or didn't die, you know, and what we have to do is focus on facts, accuracy, and then open up the process so people can see how stories are chosen. And that's what Frontline is doing and so many others.
So I guess, yeah, the challenge is trying to stay relevant when it comes to technology. Giving context with the content that we cover in our stories. And I know folks are worried about funding.
Yes.
For CPB, you know, looking down the road.
Well, every year we present our budget to the Office of Management and Budget, and we make the case. And we make the case actually based on what you do and how important it is to people in communities all throughout the country. And why it's important. And I have to say, the Public Media Caucus, Public Broadcasting Caucus, now has an even number of Republicans and Democrats. They may not agree on other issues, but they agree that this is a benefit and a value to the American people at a cost approximately, it changes, but $1.20, $1.25 per taxpayer, certainly less than a latte or a cappuccino. And we just have to make the case because it's taxpayer money. So we're obligated to do that. And I feel that's our duty, and to show how we're stewarding this money. And then we hope that the president will approve the budget and not zero us out. But that's up to the president. We do our work. We make the case and for the funding. And so far, that funding has been approved. And we're very pleased about that.
And we can underscore if you have children and grandchildren, that there can't be a better case than that, you know, for those young minds.
No, especially now, because I think John Nesbitt, who wrote Megatrends in the 80s, and he said we're drowning in information star for knowledge, and now we're drowning in misinformation. And so the more we know about our world beyond characterizations and stereotypes, the better off we will be to be a full citizen and participate and shape the kind of community and town and city and country we want.
All right. Well, Pat Harrison, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We were talking with Pat Harrison, the president and CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Her talk tonight, titled The Resilient Fourth Estate, How Factual-Based Journalism Can Survive in the Digital Era. It'll begin at 5 p.m. at the East-West Center, Emin International Conference Center. Seats are still available, but space is limited, and you are asked to register ahead of time. Head to our website to find out more.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Zippy's Restaurants, supporting farmers and ranchers in Hawaii, using more than 9,000 pounds of locally sourced beef weekly in Zippy's Chili. Learn more at zippys.com.
Joining us for today's reality check with our partners at Honolulu Beat is Washington, D.C.-based reporter Nick Ruby. He continues to track the Ke Aloha saga from across the continent. Good morning, Nick.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks so much for having me.
So what's the latest?
Well, the latest is actually a bit of a story about transparency, or actually the lack thereof. So a couple of years ago, the Honolulu Police Commission decided to give then Police Chief Louis Ke Aloha a $250,000 severance package after he was named a criminal target of a Justice Department investigation to simply retire. And to retire with good standing, which meant he got to keep his full pension and benefits, which amounted to about $150,000 a year. At least the pension alone is $150,000 a year. Well, that decision was made behind closed doors. I was there, as were a number of other reporters, sitting outside of HPD headquarters as the police commission negotiated in secret to cut this deal with then Police Chief Louis Ke Aloha. And what happened as that was occurring was a local lawyer from the Civil Beat Law Center for the Public Interest, Brian Black, told the commissioners, "I think you're breaking the Sunshine Law, which governs open meetings," and he filed a lawsuit against them. That lawsuit said, "You guys shouldn't be having these discussions behind closed doors, and we want to know what was said, so why don't you give us the minutes from that meeting?" And now we recently got those minutes from the meeting, which revealed a little bit more into how those negotiations went down.
So is there the smoking gun?
There is not really a smoking gun. I think these minutes are reflective of what most meeting minutes are show, and that's sort of a general overview of the discussions. But what it does show is that the negotiations really were between the police commission chairman at the time, Max Sword, corporation counsel Don Leong, Louis Ke Aloha, and his attorney Kevin Sumita, and they went behind another set of closed doors, out of view of the commissioners, out of view of the public, to sort of come to this agreement that the chief should walk away with $250,000 in taxpayer money. Now, one thing that's actually really important to know about all of this is that Donald Leong, who's the Mayor Kirk Caldwell's top civil lawyer, has also been issued a target letter from the Justice Department indicating that she is also suspected of criminal activity. Now, that's in relation to this $250,000 settlement, although it's unclear whether that has to do with the negotiations themselves or how the money was actually transferred to Ke Aloha.
And you write that under the terms of the retirement deal that he's got to pay back the $250,000 if he's convicted of a felony within 6 years.
Right. So part of the deal, there was a clawback provision in it, and that clawback provision said, if you're convicted within 6 years of us striking this deal, you have to pay us that money back. Now, that is sort of up for debate on how that might happen now that Ke Aloha has been found guilty of a jury. He has yet to be sentenced, and he has yet to exhaust all of his appeals. but there's a possibility that he spent all of his money. Remember, he was represented by a taxpayer-funded defense lawyer throughout this case because he basically said, I'm broke. And he said, I was broke after receiving this $250,000. So now the question is can that money be garnished in some other way, whether it's sort of going through his pension or maybe trying to get it through an asset forfeiture proceeding? That's still up. It's up in the air.
Okay. All right. Well, we appreciate your efforts in dogging this story. Thanks so much, Nick. That was a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat today, featuring reporter Nick Ruby. To read his story, go to civilbeat.org. Five years after a large colony of little fire ant was found in Nahiku, the Maui Invasive Species Committee is taking to the air to treat the infestation. Officials started this morning and are expected to continue over the next couple of days. We talked to Lisa Stroiker, the education specialist, and program coordinator Brooke Menken about what's in store. It's a rebroadcast of an earlier conversation.
It's of a pancake batter-like consistency. And so it squirts out, and we just need to get that all over about 150 acres in Nahiku, which is a densely vegetated jungle on the wet side of Maui. And so what that entails is a helicopter going up with tanks full of this gel bait and a big line that dangles down off of it. It's going to squirt out this bait, and we're going to fly back and forth like a pattern, like crop dusting, essentially, and that's going to be dependent on the weather and the wind, what direction the wind is coming from, because the helicopter is going to be flying at about 10 miles per hour ground speed, and so the wind is going to play a big role in it.
What type of pesticide are we using exactly?
So the active ingredient is metoprene, and it's an insect growth regulator. So it isn't actually toxic to the little fire ants, but it will prevent them from reproducing. So it's like a birth control, and if we continue to feed the queens this birth control, eventually all the ants will die of old age. The problem with this infestation is we can't actually go on the ground and survey for the ants in all of the areas that we need to treat. The vegetation is so thick. There's how bush in acres and acres of the infested area. And so we need to be able to treat it for a long time until we don't find any ants anywhere around the infested area. Typically, we do 1 year of treatments, and we're going to do 8 treatments in 1 year. We'll assess the situation by doing what surveys we can do at the end of that year, but it's likely that we'll need to continue treating for 2 to 3 years.
What's the acreage that we're dealing with?
The acreage, although it might slightly change depending on new information coming in, we are aiming to treat 150 acres with each treatment.
So do we have to get special permits?
Yes. So we had to get a special local needs permit to be able to use the pesticide that we're using, brand name Altacid, in this area and in this application, because we are not using it as it is labeled. So we had to get a special permit to be able to use it in this manner. And that was the work done by the Hawaii Ant Lab.
And is this something that's safe to use in streams?
That's precisely why we had to get that label, because we're restricted quite a bit to what we can use, because when we're flying and delivering this from the air, our bait is going to land in one of the streams or a couple of streams in the area. So what we're using is the insect growth regulator instead of a toxic bait, because the insect growth regulator, as I said earlier, not even toxic to the ants themselves. It's the least impactful pesticide that we could use in the area. So it's going to be, it will target the ants because they're attracted to the bait, and other things won't be affected much at all.
I think that the Hana community has been extremely concerned about the presence of a large infestation of little fire ants, you know, right in their backyard. And from the get-go, they've been, you know, wondering, like, okay, what are you doing to keep it from spreading? What are you doing to keep it from spreading? So initially with this infestation, we did treat around the area where people are present to prevent any accidental vectoring. And it's been quite a process to get both, you know, the permits as well as build the actual sprayer and, you know, get the all that together. So we've had a series of community meetings to inform the community just where we're at in this process and, you know, how they can help. And they've actually been really helpful in getting the permits approved, you know, calling and having their local elected officials express the need for this to our Department of Agriculture.
Do we know how the ants got there?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's, you know, when we found it, it was a large infestation, so it's almost impossible to trace it back.
It originated at a home, so it was definitely people that brought it.
This is the first time we're doing this spraying. Why didn't we do the spraying on the Big Island?
Maui has benefited from the Big Island in that we learned a lot, the Big Island, at their expense. The infestation there got away and out of control and was likely out of control by the time it was even discovered. On Maui, we have a chance to totally wipe out the ants. If we can tackle this infestation, all the other infestations here are under control. We could get rid of ants altogether on Maui.
So you're pretty confident, I mean, even though it's on 150 acres?
Yeah, I believe that this will work.
The folks from the ant lab, the Hawaii Ant Lab, Kaz, was saying that he worked it out per acre, and it was like 80 million ants per acre. I mean, that sounds like an awful lot of ants. So if you've got 150 acres, it's like a super colony.
Sure. When you put it that way, it sounds like a daunting task. But you have to remember that ants are a social species. So what they do is they go out and they find that bait and they bring it back and they share it with everybody and they feed it to the queen. And once that queen stops producing young, those ants will all die out from old age eventually and they're gone. So you only need to get the bait out in, you know, one droplet per square foot. Those ants will find it, seek it out, they'll go to it. So you don't have to, like, get every single ant. You just have to get it out there, and they'll go do the work for you. There are systems already developed for controlling ants from helicopters, but they are large hoppers that carry granules that are dropped on areas, and we couldn't use those granules in this situation because of the stream. And we also needed our bait, because little fire ants are arboreal and they live on the ground and all the way up to the tops of trees, our bait has to be able to stick in the tops of the trees and land on the ground. So it was an interesting, difficult process to figure out how to build a system to push this weird slurry, this gel bait, pancake batter, out of our sprayer, and with enough force to be able to cover a large enough area that we don't have to fly a really tight pattern all day long, just dribbling out a little bit of our bait.
That was a rebroadcast of a conversation we had with Brooke Mankin and Lissa Strohacker of the Maui Invasive Species Committee. They were talking about the aerial treatment that was expected to get underway today to try and beat back the massive infestation of little fire ant in Nuhiku. And, you know, after hearing this story in August, a listener wondered if she had ants on her property in Waihea. She called, the area was tested, and the results confirmed her suspicions. It's a good example of the types of stories that we bring to you on The Conversation. Hey, thanks for listening. I'm Catherine Cruz. Now back over to Pledge Central.